listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Mine, all mine. Israeli billionaire Dan Gertler set his sights on Congo to make a name for himself in the diamond mining business. But when he got there, he found cobalt, a global resource race, a whole new world of trouble, and the attention of the U.S. government. Nicholas Niarchos reports from the DRC. Opening photo, more money, more problems. The Komoto Copper Company mine in Kolwezi. And next photo, Gertler's mines, including Metal Coal Rhone Tailings Reclamation, Mutanda Mining SARL, Kansuki, and Komoto Copper Company Katanga Complex. These are shown on a map. On a freezing morning last December, President Donald J. Trump welcomed two African leaders to Washington, D.C., President Paul Kagame of Rwanda and President Felix Antoine Tshisekedi Chilombo of the Democratic Republic of the Congo were there to sign a peace deal. Rwanda and Congo have been involved in a series of conflicts in which more people died than any since the Second World War. And the two men warily avoided looking at each other as they agreed to a non-aggression pact that Trump gleefully hailed. Kagame, a wiry athletic man whose hollow eyes always seemed to be fixated on some point in the distance, and Tshisekedi, younger but slower and fond of wearing outrageously expensive watches, had made no secret of their dislike. "I know leaders when I see them. I also know idiots," Kagame once said, referring to his Congolese counterpart. For his part, Tshisekedi had compared Kagame to Hitler in the past and threatened an assault on Rwanda's capital. But Trump had brought them together at the Institute of Peace that he'd recently renamed after himself. And undergirding the diplomatic theatrics was a stark truth. The United States badly needed critical metals like cobalt that can be found in huge quantities in Congo. Brokering peace with Congo's bitter enemy, Rwanda, could be the key to securing them. For the last decade or so, a global resource war has been working its way to a fever pitch. Beijing and Washington are locked in a fight over how the future will be powered. And Congo is one of the prizes in this new great game. It is endowed with some of the richest mineral supplies on Earth, including some 70% of the world's cobalt, as well as huge reserves of copper and a Mendelevian constellation of other metals. China has long held sway in Congo, and despite Trump's vows to break the country's stranglehold globally, Beijing still controls most of the mining, refining, and production of critical metals that are used in electronics, lithium-ion batteries, and electric cars, and are expected to power the future of green energy efforts around the world. China, to use the language of competition that Trump favors, is winning. But on December 4th, the U.S. inked a deal to create a Congo-based reserve that appeared to turn the tables on Beijing. As Trump put it, "We're sending some of our biggest and greatest U.S. companies over. Everybody's going to make a lot of money." At the peace talks event, Trump hailed an end to the bloodshed, calling the deal a new framework for economic prosperity. But Congo has long been part of a frustrating region for would-be peacemakers and profiteers. In Washington, lobbyists have been arguing that there are other ways to secure the necessary resources for the U.S. There is the Venezuela option, removing leaders and using military force to pry open access to critical resources like oil. Next photos, Rock of Ages. Israeli businessman Dan Gertler arrived in Kinshasa as a 23-year-old with a family legacy to uphold and a point to prove in Africa. A grandson of Mr. Diamond wanted to show that he could strike out and make diamond deals of his own. And he stands here talking on the phone in a desolate-looking area, which is clearly a mining area. Gertler's cobalt mining operation in Congo would require the right connections, and soon he found rebel leader Laurent Désiré Kabila pictured here, and his son Joseph Kabila also pictured here. Gertler and Joseph became like brothers. And Blue Devil. After Augustin Katumba Mwanki, another significant Gertler ally, died in a plane crash in 2012, Gertler kept expanding his billion-dollar mining operation, pictured here, by investing in mines like Komoto Copper Company in the Katanga region. And there's working with people who are not exactly palatable, but who have significant sway in the region, like Dan Gertler, a billionaire Israeli businessman whose name has long been a byword for shady deals in Congo. In 2017, the Department of the Treasury said Gertler used a network of corruption in one of the world's poorest countries to enrich himself. His mining deals in Congo, NGOs alleged, relied on schemes like kickbacks and backhanders. Gertler declined repeated requests for an interview. He has always publicly denied allegations of wrongdoing in Congo or in any other country. That same year, Trump mandated a federal strategy to identify the materials that were essential for U.S. industry and growth. And now, nearly a decade later, as one U.S. legal advisor puts it, people think that you need someone like Gertler in there to counter the Chinese. Some U.S. diplomats and lobbyists are now quietly pushing the Trump administration to nix sanctions on Gertler, and as such are grappling with the complex history of figures like him, whose lust for profit is matched only by a prescient sense of what the world will need next to satiate the ravenous maw of industry and global capital. Gertler claims to have fallen in love with Congo while smoke was still rising over Kinshasa. In 1997, as the country's capital city fell to a rebel army, a 23-year-old Gertler saw an opportunity, one that would accrue to those who got in early. The country's longtime dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko, had been overthrown, and a new order was being shaped under the rebel leader Laurent Désiré Kabila. At first, Gertler was focused on diamonds. They were part of his inheritance, after all. His grandfather, Moshe Schnitzer, had been one of the founders of the Israel Diamond Exchange, and he was known as Mr. Diamond. Schnitzer was also closely connected to Israel's political and intelligence elite. The young Gertler decided to strike out on his own to see whether he could make some diamond deals away from the family business. After completing his Israeli military service, he decided to travel to Africa, where the overwhelming majority of the world's diamonds came from. He started buying rough stones in Angola and Liberia, but his ambitions were larger. The young Gertler wanted to control the supply chain, cutting out middlemen and miners and keeping more of the profits. A childhood friend of Gertler's once told journalists that the young Israeli had a particular understanding of the world. When he looks at a wooden chair, he ponders not only how it was made, but from which forest it came and what infrastructure made it possible to exploit the forest. In Congo, such a way of looking at the world would be essential. Gertler understood immediately that Congo's future was one in which well-connected insiders could make huge profits from the country's gigantic stockpile of natural resources. So he sought to make connections that would prove vital. Upon arriving in the capital, Gertler enlisted the help of Kinshasa's chief Shabbat rabbi to make the introduction to Kabila's 25-year-old son, Joseph, and the two hit it off immediately. Gertler and Joseph Kabila were separated by only 2 years, and both men carried the burden of their family legacies. Joseph, taciturn with an angular face and the shadow of a mustache, was a commander in his father's military. They became, in the businessman's later telling, like brothers. We talked about life, religion, the development of the country. They did not know it at the time, but their conversations contained within them the framework for a critical metals dilemma that 20 years later has come to preoccupy our world. By 1998, the elder Kabila wanted to establish a diamond monopoly to make more tax revenue. Joseph, who had been promoted to deputy chief of staff for the army, knew just the man, the young Israeli who had taken to spending most of his time in Congo. Gertler had begun meeting with ministers in Kinshasa and telling them that he wanted to do $2 billion in diamond deals over the next 2 years. But he was still looking for the venture that would justify his big African gamble. Joseph arranged a meeting at which his father asked for $20 million up front in exchange for a diamond monopoly. Gertler returned to Israel to celebrate. $20 million was a minute sum compared with the profit he could expect to make. 2 days after his meeting with the president, however, he received a call from one of Laurent Désiré Kabila's associates. Perhaps he hadn't understood. The president needed the money immediately. The young Gertler liquidated stock and turned to banks and his family for the cash. His grandfather personally guaranteed a loan from the Bank of Israel. The money was wired to the Swiss account of Congo's central bank. At first, it seemed as if Gertler's gamble had paid off. At the end of July, his company signed a deal worth up to $700 million that gave it control over the entirety of Congo's diamond output for 18 months. He was only 26 years old. A UN report would later call the deal one of several miscalculated decisions by Laurent Désiré Kabila. When he was putting the diamond deal together, Kabila was fighting a war against Rwanda and Uganda. He wasn't just looking for money. He was also casting about for military support, wherever he could find it. Gertler had apparently promised Israeli military training and support, leaning on the close contacts between his family and his nation's defense and intelligence apparatus. According to the United Nations, the diamond deal between Kabila and Gertler contained unpublished clauses in which IDI, Gertler's firm, agreed to arrange through its connections with high-ranking Israeli military officers the delivery of undisclosed quantities of arms, as well as training for the Congolese armed forces. The report alleged that diamonds were then flown to Tel Aviv by former Israeli Air Force pilots. We knew for a fact that there were times that the Israeli military was trolling around Mbuji Maya, Melissa Sanderson, a political officer and charge d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Kinshasa during the 2000s, told me, referring to Congo's diamond capital, and we knew he, Gertler, got them there. Gertler apparently had close contacts with the Mossad, Israel's secret service. In 2019, it was reported by Haaretz and Bloomberg that Yossi Cohen, then head of the Mossad, had traveled to Congo with Gertler at least 3 times to lobby the president. Gertler has lots of relationships in the region that are important to Israel's interest, Israel's former ambassador to Washington told Bloomberg in 2021. Gertler has always denied allegations of being involved in military aid. In a 2002 interview with the Christian Science Monitor, he made light of the allegations, sarcastically agreeing that he had put together a consortium involving the FBI, the CIA, the Russian Secret Service, and the Israeli police, army, and foreign ministry, adding that he controls the last 3. Gertler's diamond deal had attracted scrutiny from the International Monetary Fund and other international actors. The UN report called the deal a nightmare for the Democratic Republic of the Congo and a disaster for the local diamond trade. Gertler's firm was accused of cherry-picking the best diamonds, and the stones he did not buy turbocharged a smuggling boom that decimated the industry. What's more, Gertler kept some 70% of the profits from the venture, according to the BBC. Little benefit accrued to the country. On January 16, 2001, Laurent Désiré Kabila was killed, reportedly by one of the child soldiers who had been assigned to guard him. Joseph Kabila ascended to become the fourth president of Congo at just 29 years old. By April, Kabila's new government was persuaded by the IMF and the World Bank to withdraw from the contract with Gertler after only 8 months. At first, Gertler was livid. How could his friend have double-crossed him? He called Kabila over and over but got no response. He threatened legal action. Kabila's new administration convinced Gertler to cool down. They saw Gertler as an important asset to use, Sanderson told me, because of his connections to the Israeli government, and most especially to the Israeli military. Kabila appointed Gertler special envoy, and the young Israeli began traveling to the U.S. on the president's behalf. He was instrumental in brokering a 2003 peace deal between Congo, Rwanda, and Uganda. At the time, a senior Bush administration official told Bloomberg she found Gertler to be serious and credible. Those diplomatic efforts to aid Congo were not simply motivated by altruism. They allowed Gertler to curry favor while he was looking for his next opportunity, especially with an influential minister named Augustin Katumbo Mwanki, whom many believed was the power behind Kabila's throne. By April 2003, Gertler was back buying diamonds, with a convoluted deal to purchase cut-rate stones that the country's mining minister called a terrible contract for the republic. But Katumbo was also opening doors for Gertler in Congo's fabulously rich southern province of Katanga, whose fortunes were being made mining copper and cobalt. It was one of those coincidences of history. Just as more and more lithium-ion batteries were used in devices, the mines had come roaring back to life. In 2002, with the assistance of the World Bank, Congo instituted its first mining code. Katumba and Gertler were soon in business together. During this time, Gertler discovered a talent for luring investors. Even as he and his companies took on loan after loan, becoming, in one businessman's words, a debt monster, he was still able to convince people to place hundreds of millions of dollars with him. He didn't do it alone. His network included Benny Steinmetz, a businessman who was later convicted of bribery in a Swiss court, and a series of rabbis who explained to potential investors that Gertler had an almost mystical power to yield profits beyond the natural order. Two London-based businessmen, Moises and Mindy Gertner, decided to invest large sums of money because they had been told by an acquaintance that Gertler was a charismatic child prodigy with extensive and unusual connections who was capable of making a fortune. It turned out that the connections the acquaintance was talking about included Kabila's sister, Janet, and Katumba. Dan and Katumba have a tremendous relationship, Mindy Gertner later said during an arbitration resulting from a later disagreement over money. We knew from the outset that Mr. Katumba was the one helping to make things happen. For Gertler, Katumba was more than just a fixer. He was an essential part of the operation, and the Israeli made an effort to become as close to the Congolese minister as possible. If there is no Katumba, they also take away the mining license, Gertler would later say. Gertler explained during arbitration proceedings how he began to split his companies with Katumba in exchange for the state assets. things like mining licenses and oil rights that he provided to Gertler. And for his part, Gertler brought in foreign investors to buttress Congo's cash flow. Katumba's split was then paid out either as a direct cash purchase of his trust shares or as a commission on the deal of around 15% of the company. As Gertler put it, "I think everyone who was in Congo understood that Katumba's word was law." Boosted further by his connection to Katumba, Gertler would often represent himself to outsiders as uniquely powerful, the only person who could get things done in a chaotic country. He gave the impression of being very important. Charlotte Maman Ocean Simejinga, the former mayor of the mining town of Kolwezi, said that everyone relied on him to eat from his trough. During the arbitration with the Gertner brothers, Gertler, at one point, turned on a lawyer who was questioning him. "My power in Congo is that my word is my bond," Gertler said. "You don't know what trouble is. Do you know what it's like to deal with a chief who has to support 10,000 families, each with 5 children, people who are hungry for fufu, the local food there?" Gertler boasted to the lawyer, "I am a king in Congo to this day." By the mid-2000s, Gertler had amassed enormous power and assets in Congo, and the world's miners were starting to notice. In July 2006, a mining company founded by Gertler Nicanor was floated on the London Stock Exchange. The next year, a Swiss company obtained its first shares of Gertler's company, a commodity trading and mining firm with a culture of making money, it sometimes seemed, at any cost, and ended up taking a 12.5% stake. That firm, Glencore, would later pay $700 million after it pleaded guilty in U.S. federal court to a long-running bribery scheme involving foreign officials in 7 countries, including Congo. A press release from the Department of Justice confirmed that Glencore admitted to paying approximately $27.5 million to third parties while intending for a portion of the payments to be used as bribes. Gertler was not named in the suit, but was long familiar with the ways that these kinds of payments could unlock business opportunities in Congo. By the early 2010s, Gertler was at the zenith of his influence, but his reputation had begun to sour. A London financier who worked with him said, "We all knew he was a scumbag. He was someone who was malevolent." At one point, the financier went to visit Gertler in his suite at the Ritz in London. He oozed evil. Meanwhile, global demand for cobalt and copper was accelerating as battery-powered devices like cell phones became a necessity for modern life. And yet, Congo remained poor and conflict-racked. Many American firms, wary of corruption and instability, decided to stay away from business dealings in the region. During this same period, however, China, which was intensifying its quest to build electric cars to reduce pollution in its cities, jumped at the opportunity to get a handle on the supply chain. Beijing hammered out deals with Kabila to build roads and hospitals in exchange for mining rights. 25 years ago, we did not look over a horizon to say, "China's going to become an economic power whose interests are not aligned with ours," Sanderson, the U.S. diplomat, reflected. A lust for cheaper goods, cheaper electronics, had blinded Washington to Beijing's increasing control throughout the late 2000s and early 2010s. That's not to say everyone ignored the opportunity to make a buck in one of the world's poorest countries. Among the deployers of foreign capital eager to invest in the boom years was the giant New York hedge fund Oak Ziff, since rebranded as Sculptor Capital. Years later, Oak Ziff, too, would plead guilty to paying bribes in several African countries, including Congo. It was alleged that the hedge fund used a foreign agent to funnel at least $25 million to an unnamed Congolese official. That official's resume matched Katumba's, and the agent was a fixer whom the Justice Department described only as an Israeli businessman with significant interest in Congo's copper and diamond mining sectors. Media outlets and NGOs later identified that agent as Gertler, though he was never charged in the case. The DRC landscape is in the making, and I am shaping it like no one else, the agent wrote in an email recovered by federal prosecutors. In 2012, Katumba died in a plane crash. Gertler told people, including his Oak Ziff investors, that he was upset, but others read his mood differently. As one text message between Moises Gertner and another friend put it, upon learning of Katumba's death, our friend is happy he is going to save paying a lot of money, presumably referencing the payments made from Gertler to Katumba. And so Gertler, ever searching for opportunity, refocused his efforts on Joseph Kabila. In public, Gertler hailed Kabila's efforts to run the country. He's the most promising new president in the world, a new Mandela, he told Newsweek. But soon, Gertler also began to use the same kind of language to describe himself. I should get a Nobel Prize, Gertler told journalists from Bloomberg in 2012. They need people like us, who come and put billions in the ground. Without this, the resources are worth nothing. By this time, Gertler had also attracted the attention of international law enforcement, and investors in Gertler's businesses were getting nervous. On December 21, 2017, Gertler was sanctioned by the U.S. Department of the Treasury for amassing a fortune through hundreds of millions of dollars worth of opaque and corrupt mining and oil deals in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The Israeli businessman had weathered bad press, but the sanctions made him radioactive. Anyone who dealt with him now ran the substantial risk of running afoul of U.S. law. In 2018, Glencore stopped paying the royalties, estimated to be around $77,000 a day, or $28 million annually, that Gertler was entitled to under Congolese law. Gertler initiated legal proceedings, claiming almost $3 billion in past and future royalties. In early 2018, Glencore executives knew they were caught between a rock and a hard place. Chinese enterprises had been buying up copper and cobalt mines all over southern Congo, and if Glencore were to stop paying Gertler, they would all lose their cash cows. And the Chinese would be there just waiting to snap it up, as one Glencore official put it. On the other hand, Glencore executives feared their company might be targeted by the U.S. government, because even though the company was based abroad, they were paying Gertler in U.S. dollars. Ultimately, the company sent a team of negotiators to Washington to devise a solution. As a company based in Switzerland, could they pay Gertler in a different currency, such as euros? No objection was raised, and business with Gertler, the mines, and the implicit blessing of the United States government went on as usual. It was not as if Gertler was happy about the arrangement. In an interview with the Israeli paper Haaretz, two former auditors at a Congolese bank told journalists that they saw Gertler and his associates on various occasions enter the bank around that time with sacks, suitcases, and a bill counter. Soon afterward, they noticed large movements of money in accounts that were supposedly unconnected to Gertler. That was clearly an attempt to evade the sanctions, one of them said. At the end of the 2010s, it became clear that Beijing had stolen a march on Washington. The U.S. began to wake up to how many of Congo's resources, especially cobalt, were controlled by the Chinese. President Joe Biden ordered a strategic review of critical metals, and the U.S. moved away from Chinese-produced supply chains for military equipment. But by that point, China dominated in Indonesia, the second largest producer of cobalt, and the world's largest miner of nickel, another battery mineral, and was deeply entrenched in Chile and Zimbabwe, which produced large amounts of lithium. What's more, China owned stakes in 15 of the 19 largest copper and cobalt mines in Congo. One solution, proposed both by lobbyists and the Israeli government, was to use Gertler's network. But the facts on the ground had turned against the Israeli. In 2019, Felix Tshisekedi took power in Kinshasa. Gertler was sidelined as new fixers began to reap Congo's riches. In 2022, Congo began fighting a war against a Rwanda-backed rebel group called the M23, whose political wing is led by a former Kabila loyalist. Former President Joseph Kabila, Gertler's friend and best contact, was sentenced to death in absentia in 2025 after allying himself with the rebel side. Once the arbitration case, levied by Moise and Mindy Gertner, were in full swing in 2024, it became much clearer how exactly Gertler had amassed his vast portfolio of mining and oil assets that led to his sanctioning. He testified that he paid Katumba to distribute money in local communities and gave cash loans to the Central Bank of Congo. His lawyers maintained that such payments were in no way improper or unusual. In May 2024, the Treasury Department began exploring a limited easing of sanctions on Gertler to facilitate his departure from Congo, a proposal that would allow him to sell his holdings in copper and cobalt mines in exchange for withdrawing from the country entirely. The Biden administration offered to lift sanctions on Gertler if he left Congo, but negotiations stalled and his continued presence in the country remains a complicating factor in American efforts to diversify its supply chains and recapture some of the gains made by the Chinese government. Last November, the U.S. Geological Survey released its third list of materials that it said were essential for national security, economic stability, and supply chain resilience, an alphabet of substances from aluminum through copper and cobalt all the way to zinc and zirconium. The list ran to 60 minerals. China now dominates the supply chain for more than half of them. The U.S. government is encouraging companies to invest in Congo's critical metals. Kobold, a startup backed by Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, agreed to buy a stake in a huge lithium mine in Congo in mid-2025. In September, reports emerged that Glencore was in talks to sell a stake in Kamoto Copper Company, one of Congo's largest copper and cobalt operations. Potential interested parties include the New York investment firm Orion Research Partners and mining giant Rio Tinto, with potential U.S. government financing. But the talks have been complicated by Gertler's ongoing 2.5% royalty on net revenues from KCC. By some estimates, his royalties on Congolese mines will generate an average of $200,000 a day for at least another decade. An anti-corruption NGO, Global Witness, noted recently that Congo stands to lose more than $3.7 billion because of Gertler's deals, according to estimates made by the civil society coalition Le Congo N'est pas un Vendredi. Gertler has reportedly agreed to a version of the Biden plan. He will sell his royalties, which could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars, divest from Congo, and participate in an audit. The U.S., in turn, would provide a license that would conditionally lift the sanctions. Details are still being hashed out in Washington. The Trump administration is keen to do deals in Congo that give America long-term access to Congolese resources, including hosting a strategic reserve of U.S. cobalt in the country. Failing that, the U.S. government hopes to be able to source its stockpile of the critical metal from Congo. On January 12th, Congo sent its first export of copper to the U.S. The mine it came from, however, was majority owned by the Chinese. And what role, if any, will Gertler play? Currently, he is in Israel, waiting for his luck to change, and hoping powerful friends in far-off places will change it for him. Human rights groups have already sounded the alarm. The U.S. sanctions on Gertler and his corporate network were a line in the sand in preventing further corrupt deals for Congo's multi-billion-dollar mining industry, and that line should not be erased, wrote the anti-corruption campaigners John Prendergast and Sasha Lezhnev at Just Security in October. Allowing him to return would take the DRC backwards to the free-for-all days of corrupt mining deals. Unclear as whether Gertler will go quietly or if the U.S. government is even in the business of drawing lines in the sand anymore. This article was adapted from The Elements of Power, A Story of War, Technology, and the Dirtiest Supply Chain on Earth by Nicholas Niarchos. Copyright 2026 by S. Nicholas Niarchos. Reprinted by permission of Penguin Press, an imprint of Penguin Random House, LLC. I beg his pardon. The freewheeling world of mercy under Trump is less a system than a pipeline of ass-kissing and piper-paying, plus a little bit of luck. Willem Marx tours the machine, going inside some of the most high-profile, high-stakes pardon plays, from villains of reality TV to Silk Road's libertarian mastermind, to understand the cost of freedom. Illustrator Andre Carrillo contributed to this article. Opening illustration shows President Trump holding Lady Liberty in his arms. She's wearing a rather Marilyn Monroe-looking white dress, her nails painted red, a blindfold on, a sword in one hand, and the scales of justice being balanced by piles of cash. As President Donald Trump's first term neared its violent denouement on the morning of January 6, 2021, in a hushed corner suite several blocks away, a Republican lobbyist placed a call to Stephanie Grisham, the First Lady's chief of staff. He needed a favor. Awaiting the inspection of White House counsel Pat Cipollone was a batch of critical files, this lobbyist told Grisham, that were key to the future freedom of Greg Lindberg, an insurance mogul convicted in March 2020 of conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bribery for trying to influence a North Carolina politician. This lobbyist had already asked senior officials to examine Lindberg's pardon application, then pass it to the president for approval. Now, just days before Trump would leave office, the lobbyist really needed Grisham to chase down that request. No problem, she reportedly responded, happy to do it. By the end of the day, as history knows, the West Wing, where Cipollone worked, was in chaos. Grisham, who had been working from home, had resigned from her job by that night. In the days that followed, Trump granted a flurry of pardons, but Lindbergh's was not among them. Grisham told Vanity Fair she didn't remember the incident. That day was crazy. An attorney for Lindbergh said pardons should be given when the facts of the case warrant it, and that a pardon is appropriate here, not just to address the lasting harm to him, but also his family and the many people who have worked with him. Cipollone did not respond to a request for comment. In the photos, have mercy. Trump's roster of clemency recipients includes a range of convicted January 6th rioters, disgraced politicians, rappers, and reality television stars. Pictured here are Devin Archer, Joe Arpaio, Steve Bannon, Rod Blagojevich, Christina Bobb, Elliot Brady, Dinesh D'Souza, John Eastman, Jenna Ellis, Boris Epstein, Philip S. Formes, Michael Flynn, Michelle Fiore. Nearly 5 years on, with Trump back in office, the convicted, then released, then reconvicted Lindbergh has spent big to wipe his slate clean, with advisors such as Alan Dershowitz, who joined Trump's own legal team during his first impeachment, and the advocacy efforts of Keith Schiller, Trump's former personal bodyguard. Through a web of companies Lindbergh controlled, prosecutors have alleged he defrauded insurance firms and thousands of policyholders, deceived regulators, and improperly financed a lavish lifestyle. In May 2024, a jury convicted Lindbergh of conspiracy to commit honest services wire fraud and bribery, including federally funded programs. And in November 2024, he pleaded guilty to two other offenses. Schiller's firm recently listed executive pardon in a disclosure form. Schiller did not respond to a request for comment. Lindbergh is far from the only jailbird supplicant, though others have succeeded where he so far has not. High-profile pardons or sentence reductions have flowed relatively freely from the White House, absolving many felonious power players, including Ross Ulbricht, the founder of darknet marketplace Silk Road, sentenced to life in prison for a criminal enterprise that conspired to distribute narcotics and for conspiracies involving computer hacking and money laundering. Reality TV star Todd Chrisley, sentenced to 12 years for charges like bank fraud and tax evasion. Binance crypto king Changpeng Zhao, who pleaded guilty for failing to maintain an effective anti-money laundering program. And disgraced New York Congressman George Santos. How much time do you have? Along with the more than 1,500 January 6th protesters, Trump pardoned only hours after resuming office. Other would-be pardonees, whose prospects of freedom vary, read like a hit list from the greatest scandals of this century. Elizabeth Holmes, Sam Bankman-Fried, whose parents have taken up his cause, the Alexanders, three brothers accused of a slew of horrifying sex crimes, which they have denied, and, of course, Ghislaine Maxwell. One senior Republican congressman, James Comer, told Associates he'd needed to persuade Trump that pardoning Maxwell was a bad idea. Comer's office did not respond to multiple emails seeking comment. Maxwell's one-time criminal attorney, David Marcus, when told by Vanity Fair about Comer's efforts to dissuade Trump not to pardon Maxwell, responded with a single word, "Wow." The White House pointed Vanity Fair to two videos, one from Reuters in which the president says, "I don't rule it in or out, I don't even think about it," and another on the White House's YouTube channel in which Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says, "We have a very thorough review process here that moves with the Department of Justice and the White House Counsel's Office. There's a whole team of qualified lawyers who look at every single pardon request." For the hopeful, who seek indulgences from Trump like Renaissance crooks to their Pope, desirous of either pardons that entirely forgive or commutations that shorten prison time and erase fines, Trump's willingness to reimagine the pardon and commutation processes has fueled a cottage industry. It's also prompted an urgent debate over what many see as America's two-tiered justice system, where the rich ride out their legal woes on a raft of cash. Supporters say he has offered Hail Marys to those whom the justice system has failed. Next photos, Glenn Quesada, Julie Chrisley, illegally blonde. In 2022, Todd and Julie Chrisley were sentenced to 12 and 7 years, respectively, for conspiracy to commit bank fraud and tax evasion, among other charges. Todd Chrisley, Robert Cheely, Chris Collins, Henry Cuellar, Ben Dello, Cantrell Golden, Michael Grimm, Rudy Giuliani. Fraud alert! Trump's former personal lawyer and New York City mayor was symbolically pardoned for his 2020 election fraud involvement. Scott Hall, Alan Hostetter, Juan Hernandez, Duncan Hunter. "Guys, I'm just not going to do this," John Kiriakou claims. That's how Barack Obama reacted to his pardon request. "It's him or Manning," said the president, meaning Chelsea, the whistleblower convicted for violating the Espionage Act, who was imprisoned from 2010 to 2017, when Obama commuted her sentence. Obama did not respond to a request for comment for this story. Kiriakou, a former intelligence officer, had pleaded guilty to disclosing the identity of a covert CIA officer involved in the Bush administration's controversial extraordinary rendition program. He served a 23-month sentence. After his 2015 release, he lost his government pension. Just before Obama left office, Kiriakou says that some wealthy Greek Americans tried to intervene on his behalf via Vice President Joe Biden. As a senator, Biden had voted against the 1982 Intelligence Identities Protection Act, under which Kiriakou was convicted. According to the Greek Americans, according to Kiriakou, Biden had gone to the mat following a dinner at the White House. It didn't work. A few years later, under a different administration, Kiriakou said that former NYPD Commissioner Bernard Carrick, himself a Trump pardonee, suggested talking to Rudy Giuliani. Trump granted Giuliani a largely symbolic pardon, though he never faced federal charges for it. Giuliani was accused of trying to overturn the 2020 election. The moment Kiriakou and his attorney broached the subject of clemency during a meeting at what was the Trump Hotel in D.C., now the Waldorf Astoria, Giuliani inexplicably dashed off to the restroom. His chief of staff said, "You never talked to Rudy about a pardon. You talked to me about a pardon, and I talked to Rudy," according to Kiriakou. The Giuliani aide told him that the fee would be $2 million, says Kiriakou, who laughed at the aide then and laughs again now. "I said, look, I don't have $2 million. I'm never going to have $2 million. And even if I did, why would I spend $2 million to recover a $700,000 pension?" Kiriakou stood up, shook hands, and left. America's mayor was still in the bathroom. Carrick passed away in May. A spokesperson for Giuliani did not comment. Next photos, Scott Jenkins, Brian Kelsey, Bernard Carrick, Kwame Kilpatrick, Charles Kushner, Troy Lake, Kathy Latham, Roger Stone, P.G. Sittenfeld, Peter Schwartz, Christian Saucier, George Santos, Rick Renzi, Stuart Rhodes, and Revolt. The founder of the Oath Keepers was released from prison after he was convicted of seditious conspiracy in the January 6th attacks. Joe Arpaio had better luck. As Maricopa County, Arizona sheriff for 24 years, Arpaio earned a national reputation for hardline policies. He forced inmates to wear pink boxer shorts and work in chain gangs, and encouraged deputies to sniff out pretext to detain people and examine their immigration status. A Fourth Amendment violation he touted in press releases and on TV. Eventually, Justice Department lawyers, including trial attorney John Keller, decided there was sufficient evidence to prosecute Arpaio for criminal contempt, an unusual charge for a public office holder. In late July 2017, then 85-year-old Arpaio was convicted of willfully disregarding a judge's order. One Friday evening, a few weeks after the trial ended, Keller checked his phone as he emerged from the D.C. Metro. Trump, having teased the possibility several times, had gone ahead and pardoned Arpaio before he was even sentenced. "I guess this is how this administration is going to operate," Keller recalls thinking. "There was no process. There was no consultation with the prosecution team. It was clearly and blatantly because of a political alliance between the public figure who was convicted and the president." It was also the first time someone Keller had prosecuted received a pardon, and the first pardon he knew of granted before sentencing. Green Beret Matthew Goldstein, accused of killing an unarmed Afghan man whom he believed was a Taliban bomb maker, has since received clemency before sentencing. So did Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, for lying to the FBI. And Steve Bannon, charged with conspiracy to commit wire fraud and conspiracy to commit money laundering. "In retrospect," says Keller, "Arpaio was a canary in the coal mine." On January 20th, 2021, the final day of Trump's first term, Trump pardoned Republican fundraiser Elliot Broidy, whom Keller had prosecuted for violating foreign lobbyist rules. Senior Department of Justice officials had initially instructed the prosecuting team to pursue a lighter sentence against Broidy, says Keller. The DOJ did not respond to a request for comment. In January of Trump's second term, Keller had become acting chief of the Public Integrity Section, which focuses on corruption cases involving public office holders. But within weeks, Keller disagreed with the dismissal of corruption charges against then-New York Mayor Eric Adams, and he resigned. Since the start of 2025, the once vaunted public integrity team has shrunk from some 30 prosecutors to just a handful. The rooms where it happened. Alexander Hamilton encouraged the framers to enshrine the concept of mercy in the Constitution. Many presidents have used Article II powers judiciously. John Adams pardoned participants in Freeze Rebellion of 1800. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln pardoned many Union deserters. After it, Andrew Johnson blanket pardoned nearly all Confederate soldiers. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Or you can ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.